Greetings, everybody. This is Krish Dunham back to you from my studio in Dallas, Texas. Hope you're doing well wherever in the world you are. It is a balmy Tuesday here in the great state of Texas. We have had some record heat, no rain, and so I have enjoyed the travel to some of the cooler parts of the world, being in Canada most recently and then a little south of here where it was as hot but probably slightly less. Next week, head to San Francisco, where we're looking forward to the cooler weather there, then Chicago, and then on to India. So the beat goes on. Some is hot, some is cold, but that's like our messages and our missives. Continuing and diving right along into the losing the culture war narrative, the character assault and the Christian answer, we have already presented for you three distinct parts of that. First was the deviation, then was the distortion, then was the delusion. Today we're going to talk about the declaration, but if we were going to do a really quick recap for those of you who are tracking, and hopefully that will give you the needed incentive to go back and listen to the first three. This talk has been galvanizing itself in terms of the thought process that is being provided. And a lot of people are now asking me to speak about these issues, bringing into context the history and the historicity of where we are as a people and why we have succumbed to the broader narrative of mass disinformation and the parade of lies. Within the construct of the deviation, we presented to you four distinct characters, two that are quite popular, Huxley and Orwell. Huxley, of course, of Brave New World and Brave New World Revisited fame, and Orwell of 1984 and Animal Farm. Orwell wrote his book in 1948, predicting a 1984 dystopia. Huxley wrote his book much earlier in 1931, predicting a different kind of dystopia. Huxley's moods that he painted were that we would arrive into a society of stability, identity, and community that sound really good and grandiose verbiage that actually says who doesn't want stability, who doesn't want a great identity for every individual, and who doesn't want the harmony of community. But each one of those have with it a diabolical plan. In order to give you stability, first they have to knock off your foundations a la Stalin. In order to give you identity, they have to restore definitions. And in order to give you community, they have to do boundary bashing and constantly malign those who belong to a different class or caste group. Orwell talked about war will be peace, freedom will be slavery, and ignorance will be strength. Those three have played themselves out. Speaking to a group of young conservatives about a week and a half ago, I was offering them these ideas, and most of them had raised their hand when I asked, do you think we are in an Orwellian world? And they all thought we were, that the control and the coordinated efforts to thwart human freedoms are quite rampant. And then I presented to them The Media is the Message, which was Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, and actually offered them a parallel, saying maybe we are more in a Huxleyan world where we are too entertained by what is presented to us, so we are almost apathetic to a counterculture or a counterworldview. The second thing we've said that was brought on by the advent of this deviation is the distortion. Equality began to replace fairness, justice replacing mercy, moral lawgiver is jettisoned and abdicated, and man's morals are ushered in by a new law that is articulated, argued, debated, accepted, and acknowledged by man himself. He becomes the supreme authority of all that is fair and just. There is no conscience that precedes us. We are what we are. René Descartes famously said, I think, therefore I am. Modern man is probably a little more egotistical when he walks around parading like a peacock saying, I am, therefore I think. Now, the third one was the delusion, where we began to talk about the subsects of vocabulary, grammar, identity, fluidity, feelings versus facts, and all of these broad things that trigger people. That's another word. People automatically use the word, when I hear this, I'm triggered. And it's fascinating that they are so very quick to jump on the bandwagon of being hurt. If you've not subscribed to my newsletter, Sky Life Success produces one every week. And this past week, I talked about the practicality of parables. And I got a little bit of email from and mail from other people who said they like the construct, but they think modern leaders are living in a delusion where they are diluting their vocabulary, altering their grammar, fracturing their identity, encompassing and embarrassing themselves with thought processes that are so fluid that have no origin, and are actually succumbing to feelings versus facts. And as a result, they don't tell the stories of old, the stories of gold that actually moved civilizations and allowed history to be redefined in populist ways. Now, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, a movie by Clint Eastwood some years ago, kind of chronicled that title, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. In every human part, in every human endeavor, there's always been good, there's always been bad, then always been ugly. One famous philosopher said, if you keep judging philosophies by their abuse, you will never understand the good that they intended to do or maybe even did. Rome may not have done very good things in the end as it succumbed to its own debauchery and fell to its own immorality, but Rome was a mighty empire that on one side had stretched from Constantinople, which was Byzantium and the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, modern Istanbul, all the way to the west and what they predict was as far as Hadrian's Wall in modern-day UK. But when you look at Rome in its totality and you look at its might, you look at Greece and its Hellenistic history and its might, whether you look at Napoleon's advances, whatever part of history you look at, if you look at the Afghan and the Mughal invasion into India and their rule there for six centuries that then began to end with the beginning of colonization, the people that are free now and have expressed that freedom for the past 75 years were ruled by somebody or part of fiefdoms or cultures or emperors or monarchies. But from each one of those, we did get some good. We did get some bad, and we got some downright ugly. If our whole desire is always revisionist and we go back to revisiting and rewriting and erasing that which made us, in addition to erasing the bad and the ugly that are the scars of modernity that show on the backs of the people who are born that oppression, you will also erase the good that actually gave some amount of success. Which brings us to the declaration, which is the three moods I want to present to you that came from one great apologist, and that is secularization, which is where religious instructions, individuals, identities have lost their social significance. And as a result, there is a loss of shame. When religion has begun to be taken away from society, the grand declaration of a so-called evolved people is that we are going to rewrite our own morality. Then this is the beginning of that concept of where you go down the way and ask yourself, is there anything wrong with anything anymore? When secularization raises its ugly head, you begin the process of the loss of shame. Shame is something that is part of cultures. We were allowed to do some things and not allowed to do other things. We were told that we could push the envelope as young teenage boys, but there would come a line in the sand at which your parents would not be disappointed because of your behavior, but they would be disappointed because of the shame you brought on the family. So there was a social taboo that was of cultural significance. There's a religious taboo of moral significance. And secularization erased that by simply saying we cannot have one kind of morals over other kind of morals. So rather than have the concept of trying to define which morality works, why don't we just come with a loosey-goosey framework of everything goes? Well, on its heels will come pluralization, which is the loss of reason. If everything goes, anything goes. Here's where you end up with man and barn and man and barnyard. Recently, in one of the states in the United States, a man took his computer or electronic device to the municipal hall and said, is there any way I can legally marry this? Because I'm addicted to it, I'm in love with it, it gives me purpose, it gives me some amount of pursuit. The people looked at him like he had just stepped off an alien comet of some kind and said, you are out of your mind. What do you mean you want to marry your computer? He said, well, it gives me purpose, it gives me love, it doesn't judge me. It allows me to be who I am. Why can't I marry it? He said, sir, this is an inanimate object, and besides, marriage is between persons. He says, well, we have already redefined marriage to not be between people of the opposite sex. It can be now of the same gender. So why do you get concerned when I want to marry something that is inanimate? And this is what I mean by loss of reason. When you move from everything goes to anything goes, pluralization brings into account that old G.K. Chesterton definition. Be careful of which fence you drop if you never asked yourself why it was up there in the first place. The third, and which is one of the most devastating things that most cultures have seen, is this thing called privatization. Now, in places which had large geographical boundaries, something called suburbia began to spread about the middle of the 60s. Now, post-World War II, many people came back and got involved in the industrial machine of rebuilding their societies and re-inhabiting their locales, which were either devastated or bombarded. But then this concept of suburbia began to emerge, which was privatization. I don't want to be part of a center that has no conscience. I don't want to be part of the core that has no collective responsibility. So I'm going to go on to the periphery where I can raise my fences and raise my children in isolation, and I can create for them an identity. But what individually and collectively happened and corporately was exhibited was this thing called loss of identity. Privatization said, if I don't like what you do and I don't like where you go, then I pick up my tools and I go. And we did. I'm guilty as anybody else as I moved away to suburbia from a commute that was very quick to a commute that was long. But at the end of the day, I believe that if I raised my fences in isolation and was not part of the parades that were endlessly marching downtown or the protests that would take in front of City Hall, I was isolating myself from a community and able to enjoy the life that I had dealt for myself. But in this process, my loss of identity went to a different degree. Because within any declaration, there are three motifs that are presented. One is every argument that society begins to have has to be shaped either at a philosophical level, at a media-driven level, or at a kitchen table level. Again, this is quoting the great apologist of yesteryear. But if you do that, then what ends up happening is that you're looking at this concept of philosophical argument, and there are not a lot of people either in suburbia, in your commute, in your offices, on the airplane ride, or in the airport that are going to look at you eye to eye, hand to hand, and with great whispers and incredible adoration talk about the rhetoric of Aristotle or the Academy and its pursuit of Hellenistic mastery. They're going to talk about something as trivial as mowing the yard or keeping your yard green or complying with the homeowners association rules of how we all have to follow the speed limit. Now, that's tongue-in-cheek, but what privatization did was it lost us our ability to think like people, and we created these little pockets of groupthink that it was as devastating because in that community we raised our children. But when we raised our children, we raised them to go back into this world, but they had been raised in relative isolation. Every time I meet people who are homeschooled, I actually see people who have never been indoctrinated by the so-called academy. But by the same token, I see people who do not even understand the hardships of reality that the world exhibits and experiences at the center. Now, this was a little more heady in terms of the declaration, but ask yourself, when secularization gave us the loss of shame and pluralization gave us the loss of reason, privatization inevitably produced for us the loss of identity. And as a result, we're all shouting for our own identity, trying to find some part of our past that has a semblance of reality in the present. But that ship has already sailed. We have decided we're going to erase the past because the past was bad and every atrocity that was ever committed was horrific, and man can never learn anything from history. So that's the grand declaration, and you need to ask yourself in this journey called life, what are you going to do as your answer? Because think about it. Recently at an education gathering, I asked people, when they think of the word academy, what do they think about? And these are educators, and to a T, all of them said the Oscars, because the academy is now a place where a statue that is made of whatever, it looks golden, is presented to people who actually take on a role of becoming somebody else. And the better they do at that role and the more believable they are in that role of acting as someone else allows them to covet and get this golden statue. And once they get that statue and they are deemed an Oscar winner, their life forever changed, their trajectory forever improved, and the good roles will come to them. But when I asked educators, when you think of the word academy, what you think about, and they all said the Oscars, I thought to myself, Not one of them for a second said, oh, I'm thinking of the academies of Socrates, Plato, and Alexander. And Alexander the Great's desire to increase Aristotle's academy by furthering Hellenistic history, by bringing back fauna and flora from his conquest so that the academy would have learning ability through specimens that were both live and dead. But these people were so myopic, they thought the Oscars is an academy. They didn't even think of an educational academy or the very academy of university, the unity within diversity. Then I posited a second question saying that if the academy is what you think it is, the Oscars, when you think of the Oscars, what do you think? Thinking for a second, maybe they would go back in history and see the gallant riding of that horse down that valley with the one-eyed wonder himself in that movie True Grit, as John Wayne portrayed with the reins in his mouth and blazing guns from both hands. What a scene that was, worthy of an Oscar. Or maybe they would think of Burt Lancaster, or they would think of Paul Newman, or they would think of any of the other people, Charlton Heston, who gave us some of the great epic performances that brought that vision of artistry onto the screen and actually portrayed a character. Marlon Brando and Meryl Streep. I thought they would talk about that. When I said, when you think of the Academy, you're saying Oscars. When you think of the Oscars, what do you think of? And to a T, all of them said the slap that was heard around the world. One man getting up, who himself won an Academy that night and was not remembered for that, but was remembered for the slap. And I thought to myself, the grand declaration that we have made in this privatization, secularization, and pluralization journey, when the loss of shame, the loss of reason, and the loss of identity is now the number of times a loop of a video makes different social media streams that make you think that that is what is reality. Next time when we come back, we'll talk about session 5, which is the decision. And then session 6 will be the destination. Trust me, we're getting to some solutions. But thank you for bearing with me so long. Until next time, this is your humble host, Krish Dunham. Good luck. God bless.
Welcome to The Pursuit of Purpose, a podcast made possible by SkyLife Success, a SkyPass Group company. Join Krish Dunham, an author and speaker whose messaging has been described as the junction where God's ability and man's availability meet hope's accessibility. And that concludes another episode of The Pursuit of Purpose with Krish Dunham, brought to you by SkyLife Success. Please subscribe, rate, and visit us on the web at krishdunham.com and skylifesuccess.com, where you can find our social media links and access to additional resources. Till next time, happy learning and happy living.